I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Well, thank you everyone for being here today to celebrate the launch of Sophie's third novel, Cursed Bread. Happy publication day
thank
is today. For those of you who haven't read Cursed Bread, which may be a fair few because, I don't know, who's rushed in early this morning and read the whole thing today, but you're in for a treat. It's a novel that simmers with heat and feeling and that feels a threat at bubbling over at any point. It's really like an exploration of the kind of fearsome power of desire and want, like how desire for another person, for another life, for something still inscrutable can consume a person, can remake them, and can maybe destroy them as well. I think that this novel has everything that readers love in Sophie's writing. The way that the senses are set alight, the tight, controlled prose, which somehow releases intense colour, smell, feeling. There's a kind of insistent vividness to Sophie's writing. You are never not within where she places you, and her characters are tenacious and loud, even when they're uncertain. And there have already been great reviews. The Telegraph have hailed Cursed Bread as a shimmering fever dream of a novel, which sounds pretty good. The Guardian call it gripping, a quietly rich maturation of McIntosh's skill. And someone on Goodreads has said, who knew mass poisoning could be so sexy? Which sounds good. But anyway, let's move on to getting the author to say something. So we thought we could start by maybe reading from Cursed Bread and also just explaining a little bit about what the novel's about.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here on publication day as well. It's really lovely to see so many people here and to celebrate this with you, my weird little book. So Cursed Bread is based like incredibly loosely on a true story, which in 1951... the town of Pont-Saint-Esprit in South France was suffered a mass poisoning event, and the whole town kind of was struck down by hallucinations. And I think I read it in a kind of one of those articles that was like stranger than fiction. I remember reading it and thinking stranger than fiction indeed. And I've always been fascinated by kind of mass poisoning events and kind of mass hysteria events, and I sort of filed it in my brain as an interesting story, but somehow kind of kept returning to it. And over the years, it kind of turned into something else, not really even about the poisoning so much, but I think, you know, more about how, I guess, the backdrop of the poisoning became a setting for thinking about how, you know, how permeable reality can be, and what happens to our kind of our relationships with each other against that kind of background. And so I'm just going to read from the beginning of Cursed Bread. Actually, I'll just read the epigraph as well, which is by Sarah Manguso, just because I think it's sort of, fitting. Nothing's gone, not really. Everything that's ever happened has left its little wound. When I recall the first time I met Violet, it embarrasses me. I hold the memories up to the light and think, did it really happen like this? And even if it did, why not tell it differently, more generously? Why don't I pretend even to myself? There's nobody left to know, nobody who could catch me out. I could say that she came in and took my hands in hers and looked into my eyes and said she always wanted a friend, a true friend, that she could see we were alike, with twin ravaging hearts under our ribs. My dour blouse could not conceal that from her. I could say that she picked me out of everyone in the town, was drawn along the sun-bleached stone of the pavements by hunger, by instinct, to where I had always stood, waiting. I could say a lot of things, but perhaps it's best to be honest now. I didn't sense her walking towards me on that chill morning in early spring, didn't notice her opening the door to the bakery. Her hair was dark and loose, spilling over her stiff white blouse and the lace at its collar. She hung behind the other customers, looking at the loaves stacked behind me one by one as if making an important decision. The other women in the shop greeted her. "Welcome," they said. "We've been expecting you." She smiled at that, and I had to stop myself from brushing my hand against hers when I passed her the loaf she finally chose. But I couldn't say much to her. I was afraid of her. She thanked me and left, and through the window I saw her pause and open the paper bag for a second, as if she was considering tearing into the bread like a dog. But she didn't. She closed the bag and then was gone. I stared after her until the next customer, I don't remember who, interrupted me, impatient for their breakfast. "You've seen a ghost," they joked, snapping their fingers. When I returned home later, I found my husband asleep on our bed. He slept like a baby, insensibly, with his arms thrown out. I passed my hands over his body, not quite touching, along those splayed arms and along his legs, and finally, gently lowered my palms to his chest. He was fully dressed. I climbed onto the bed and folded myself on top of him. His breathing changed, but he refused to admit he was awake. "Please," I asked him. I pressed my face into his neck. He was sweating. I wanted to put my hand over his mouth so he would stop pretending, but I knew he would rather suffocate than be caught. He kept his eyes closed. I battered at his arms, his cheeks very lightly, and then less lightly, and then not very lightly at all. I can admit that in those days I was sometimes jealous of the dough my husband put his hands into, worked so tenderly and tirelessly with up to the elbows. I can admit now that his bread really was the best. There was such beauty in breaking it open hot from the oven and the steam pouring out, in feeling your appetite worrying at you and knowing it would soon be sated. The astonishing fact that, living as we did in this new time of peace and plenty, we might never have to feel hungry again. He was on a constant mission to perfect it. You might have said it was his life's work. You might have said this not entirely seriously, but he was very serious about it. I was jealous too of the purity of his focus, the incremental moves towards one faultless loaf. But what then, when there was nothing left of the bread to improve? What then? Eat of it and be filled. Eat of it and be transformed. Eat of it and nothing changes. The almost imperceptible recalibration of our desire, our satisfaction. Try again.
So, you know, you've spoken about, you mentioned the historical seed that it kind of begins, it began with for you. But I mean, how did it get from reading this article to it becoming something so, you know, about these particular characters, about Violet and Elodie and the ambassador? What was the kind of journey to that particular obsession?
Yeah, I just realised I kind of mentioned the event and I didn't really speak that much more about actually the background behind it. So I think when you kind of live in a story for so long and when you've kind of, I'm so familiar now with this kind of historical thing. So the event that kind of led to the poisoning has never been proved. But the kind of the main theory that seems most likely is that it was poison flour. So that's kind of been the thing that everyone's working on. And so the story follows Elodie, the baker's wife, and kind of her summer preceding the poisoning as she becomes obsessed with a couple who arrive in the village. Because another theory, which is the one that kind of held a bit more fascination for me, was that it was all part of a mind control experiment by the CIA. So a more outlandish one, but one that, you know, sort of grabbed onto me. And so sort of melding these two theories and thinking about how they could have combined and what could have possibly happened is where Curse Spray came from. So the story follows Elodie, the baker's wife, and her obsession with this new glamorous couple who come to the town and seem to have a life that she kind of has always wanted and doesn't have. And yeah, like Rebecca has said, that idea of this sort of desire, this propulsive desire taking hold of her and changing like the trajectory of her summer.
And it's kind of told in retrospect, right? So we have the beggar's wife, Elodie, and she's kind of remembering these things or kind of like asserting what's happened to her and what we're trying to assert. And in Tweed as well, these like letters that she writes to Violet. And I was really interested in like when you decided that you would tell the story in retrospect rather than kind of putting us into it happening live. Like, what was it about what you get from kind of a retrospective telling that convinced you?
I think in the writing of the book, it was really hard figuring out the best way to find the narrative and the best way to kind of tell the story. And I actually wrote many drafts anyway, but with Kiss Bread, I wrote a couple of previous drafts through different voices where I kind of got like quite far in the book and then realised it wasn't working. I think as Elodie is a super unreliable narrator and she's someone who is a bit of a fantasist and she's very caught up in kind of her dreams, her fantasies, her memories more than anything. And so by having the two narratives, the one that's kind of a bit more of a traditional one where she's kind of, you know, telling us, the audience, what happened that summer, telling us about her feelings for the couple, telling us like the story itself. But then we have these letters where in the present day she, you know, she's existing. The event has happened. We don't really know much about it. We just know that she's here somewhere else addressing Violet. So clearly something has happened. But that idea of her addressing Violet, she's kind of at her most honest because she's incredibly unreliable with us all the time. And just the idea of these two narratives where someone, I guess, can be more honest or more themselves. And we don't really know, like, who's the real Elodie? Like, what is the real story? What is she actually, you know, what's actually happened? What's her actual experience been? It's sort of this, like, private... I mean, she's talking to Violet, but she's also kind of talking to herself.
And when you were writing it, did you feel like you were certain about who she was yourself? Or was she like a kind of mystery that you were kind of unravelling as you were writing it?
I think, yeah, a character's kind of... I mean, it sounds like cheesy to be like, characters surprise you, because, I mean, you're literally in control. but it's that thing of kind of, I guess, the more you think around a character and the more you develop a character and the more you come to understand what you're trying to say, the more kind of layers you uncover. And, yeah, it was kind of... through writing those letters to Violet, that was kind of how I felt. I got more of an understanding of Elodie and what she was actually trying to achieve, you know, in her entire obsession, what she was trying to achieve in the telling of her story. Because I think, so much of the book is about narrative and is about, you know, how a story is told and who tells the story and how a story is different when it's told by another character. And that was something I learnt, you know, with the other drafts when I was kind of thinking about how to tell the story of the ambassador and Elodie and Violet, because one of my earlier drafts was in Violet's voice, and I was kind of interested how it was kind of like, it was quite dead, and I was kind of halfway through, and I was like, why is this not working? And then I was like, oh, Violet's kind of a character who is not actually like very interesting to hear the story from her perspective. It's more interesting to hear it from someone else's, and that realization kind of, I don't know, I think this, I'm sure you find it yourself with writing, you sometimes have these moments in a book where, you know, you have all the stuff in place. Like, I was like, okay, I've got this amazing story, I've got this great idea, I've got these notes, I've done everything, but it's not quite working. And that was the moment the narrative kind of made it come together. That makes sense. It kind of just sort of everything sort of clicked, and I was like, I see what I'm trying to do.
Completely. And do you, because obviously with the Water Cure and Blue Ticket, like, those are often described as like feminist dystopian fiction. Do you feel like Cursed Bride is a move away from that? Do you think it's placed within our world rather than your own world? Or do you think that the kind of boundaries and rules still are kind of distinct from here?
I think definitely it's in our world, but I also think I do like the idea of it occupying a kind of space with those other books too, even if it's not kind of explicitly speculative. You know, it's a super loose telling of the story. I like to think of it as like historical speculation. And, you know, it's still kind of, I never mention the town by name. It's all you know, it is still quite vague, which I've kind of done on purpose because I kind of wanted it to feel out of time and out of place. And I almost think, like, sometimes when I'm reading historical fiction, or, you know, you can kind of get a little bit bogged down by the detail, or you can feel like very placed in one time. And I definitely kind of didn't want people to feel like, to kind of be getting distracted by, like, oh, this is like a very inaccurate historical detail, or like, this is a very specific place. I should be feeling a very specific thing about, like, this, or I should, you know, I think I just love to borrow, which I think it'd also be annoying, because I think if you are expecting a retelling of the story, much as like with Blue Ticket and The Water Girl, if you are expecting a kind of a very specific kind of dystopia which is fleshed out and you're kind of exploring things, you're maybe not going to get what you signed up for. And I think that's maybe something that might happen with Chris Bird, with historical fiction fans, but I'm hoping that people will kind of enjoy that kind of dreamlike state, which is more the kind of thing I was aiming for.
Yeah. Do you think that there's almost like a, because it sits as your third novel, which follows two other novels that, you know, have really explored a kind of other world, explored a kind of dystopian framework, that people are more likely to apply that to Cursed Bread and kind of go into it expecting another world?
I think so. I hope so, because I don't think, I think if you have read my books before, no one's going to be like, I think it'd be more surprising to be like, oh, this is like, you know, incredibly like detailed 800 page novel about, like, you know, daily life in France in the 50s. Being able to like take something and use it as a launching off point, to have this exploration of, you know, like ideas and that freedom to kind of move in a world that is uncanny and not quite ours, I just find it a really fruitful space. I can't remember, I think there was a writer who coined the term, but my agent Harriet, she gave it to me once. It's called fruitful ambiguity, which I think was like a really lovely term, that idea of there being this space around the known, where we can kind of fill in the gaps, not in a way of being kind of purposely ambiguous, but just, you know, or kind of like leaving too many gaps because you don't know what's happening, but in giving people a framework to, you know, have their own experience and to, I guess, suspend disbelief a bit and to kind of go into this almost like trance-like state. Maybe that sounds like silly, but yeah.
No, but definitely. And I feel like it's such an obviously fertile ground for you, and it's kind of like, I don't know, like even if you were writing like incredibly true to this room, this world, the way that you kind of conjure feeling and like being inside someone's space, the way that they see things is so particular to them that you instantly feel kind of in a kind of otherworldly territory. And I feel like that's such a kind of credit to what you do, which is that you create such a kind of particular interiority that you're instantly kind of transcended, you're taken somewhere else. And when I was reading it, I kind of wondered, this is maybe like just making you ask a big question because you've written a book, but do you think women can like struggle to pedestal their feelings, to kind of give significant weight to how they feel? Because I thought that the Elodie's kind of narration, her way of looking in retrospect, was kind of a way of subverting or kind of resolving that idea of always diminishing feelings.
I think, that idea of always having to sort of justify or reduce your feelings is something that comes up again and again in my work. But I think with Cursed Bread, Elodie has these massive feelings that she doesn't understand. And I think as well, there's like, in Cursed Bread, like no one's really listening to Elodie. It kind of, in a way, doesn't matter if she has these like massive feelings, because she's kind of just like, no one's really understanding or like listening to her or really seeing her. So that sense, I think, of, she's having all these feelings which she can, are so intense, and no one's kind of like really noticing them blossoming. And in the letters, there's definitely the sense of rumination. That was a kind of conscious thing that I was doing in the letters. Also that sense of kind of, she's just had, you know, she's gone through this incredibly traumatic event, like both the massive trauma of the poisoning and also, you know, the trauma of this like love affair, which is kind of, you know, maybe not been what she's expected it to be. Her entire reality has kind of changed. And this sense of, if you can just like go over the pieces enough, if you can kind of return to something, if you can go to a memory again and again and again, you can almost like find the key, you can find some kind of closure, but you think you can't always. You kind of just, you know, you can try to make sense of something, you can go to it again and again, but it's not necessarily productive in that way.
Mm. I really like that, the kind of sense of like almost being on like a scavenger's hunt, and she'd kind of go back to memories or ideas and see whether they fit better if she returned to them. Mm. And it really feels, I don't know whether this is how you feel when you write, but that in many ways, like, plot can be as much be like about just like exploring feeling or exploring the body, and that those have a kind of story as much as like, you know, writing a kind of grand historic event.
Yeah, completely. That idea of having this like kind of big historic event, but the main focus is on like her feelings and her relationship. I think it's just that idea of like training a microscope on something rather than like kind of zooming out almost. And you know, it felt like a very physical book to write. And also, like, reading it back, I was struck by how kind of visceral it is and how like how really intense it is. And and I think the main thing is, I think the memory as well, that there's so much memory in the book, and even reading that like first bit there, I was just reminded, I guess, of how when I was writing it, like, memory was the thing I kept kind of thinking about, how the actual experience of memory can feel physical, how it can feel bodily, how it isn't just emotional, but, you know, like, you can kind of live a memory like it's a room. You can kind of return to something, and every time you return to it, I think I remember reading, I can't remember, but it might have been in the book that the epigraph came from, Sierra Manguso, this idea that once you remember something, it's like always a bit different. So like, kind of your memory is never actually completely correct, because every time it's like alter something in the remembering, you lose something or you gain something. And so this idea in the book that, you know, Elodie is always kind of misremembering, and she's losing, like, every time she thinks about a treasured memory, every time she thinks about something that she has, something that she experienced, it's, you know, it's different and it's a loss. As well.
Yeah, Maggie Nelson says that in Bluettes about like memories becoming.
Maybe that,
like,
was where I read it, actually. Quite probably.
Well, maybe it is, because it does fit so well, which is like a photo album of childhood photographs, and like when you look at it, that kind of replaces what you might remember of your true memories, and you have this kind of very cemented idea of it. And yeah, like, do you think the kind of that's what kind of fascinates you the most, the kind of unreliability of that, of like, because for Elodie, like, she's trying to be as precise and assert as possible, while like completely, you know, falling against the fact that it's impossible to ever be certain of what happened.
Yeah, completely. Like, she doesn't know what happened. All she has is like this kind of this collage of like memories, but also things that she's been told. It's almost, yeah, I kind of just imagined her in the present day narrative, like, she's basically just piecing together everything she has. She's trying to like figure out the links, she's trying to figure out the missing pieces, but she'll kind of never get there, and it's always eluding her. And it's kind of living in her memories is like this torment, but also this comfort. And yeah, that was something I kind of was thinking about a lot.
And you're right when you say it's, you know, very, very visceral and very, very intense to read. And I think that's something that's, you know, obviously familiar in Blue Ticket and the Water Cure, which is these very like strong first person voices that you're just completely like overwhelmed by. And I feel like voice is really like the bricks and mortar of your writing. And, you know, all of these worlds that are so intense are conjured by the way that like one or several voices present it to us. And I mean, how important is voice to you? And do you think you would ever not write in the first person?
That's so interesting. Yeah, I've been thinking about that, because yeah, it is three novels with a really strong first person voice, like deeply interior, really, really interior, very much about like their internal monologue, which is, you know, can be exhausting. And I'm actually like, yeah, I'm working on something now, and it is in like third person, and it's so different an experience to be writing something where you're the observer and not the person going through it almost. It's again, it's like I am just sort of fascinated by this idea of like how a story changes depending on how we approach it, like who tells it, and like, you know, how much distance we want from it, how much we want to be working things out, or how much we want to be just told a story. Like, do we want to be like involved, or do we just want to kind of listen?
and how are you finding it? Like,
kind of like enjoying it. Yeah, really just finding it very odd.
Is it also because you started by writing poetry, didn't you? And I was thinking about that when you were saying a minute ago about the kind of the magnifying glass, like really, really like telling a big story by going very, very specific. Do you think that comes from poetry, both potentially the first person, although not necessarily writing first person, but also just the kind of, yeah, specific imagery, the kind of just tuning in on a tiny moment?
I think so. Like, obviously, a poem is so kind of distilled, and it's almost like I feel like I came to, like, distillation backwards. Like, I started from, like, a poem and then gradually expanded into short stories, then was, like, gradually expanding into novels, where it feels like it should kind of be opposite. But, yeah, that idea of, I guess, in a way, like, I just always loved, like, finding, like, that one perfect image or finding that, like, one perfect sentence. But I kind of need more than that for a book, unfortunately. You can't have a book made up of, like, perfect sentences. But I think that idea of, like, really slowing down and just kind of finding that moment, finding that key image, but also, like, so much can blossom out from that key image, so much is around that key image, so much happened to make that key image happen. And I think sort of getting excited about those possibilities and tapping into that, I think all the stuff around a beautiful image or a beautiful kind of moment in writing is really important, all the things that happen around a character. And yeah.
But also, like, when you have all those kind of specific shards that conjure a world and kind of in bits where you're not shown the whole thing, like, do you kind of think that's really important, because there's so much space within that for the reader to imagine? And I don't know about you, but I kind of feel like that it's so important in writing to leave those spaces for the reader to attach themselves to it with their own imagination.
I think it is important. I feel like in Kiss Bread I didn't do that so much, because it feels quite, I guess because it's quite compressed, it kind of takes place one narrative over a summer and the next narrative, like, you know, obviously a while on. I suppose we have sort of the gap which happened in between. But I think it is, again, like that kind of, like, that fruitful ambiguity thing. I think it is good to, like, have that space to kind of, to imagine and to, you know, create your own interpretation.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
And I have to ask this question, even though it's a question that I think we both got asked basically as soon as the pandemic happened. And it was like, I don't even know the effect yet. Stop asking how it affects my writing. But I mean, obviously you must have written a lot of this, all of it, during the pandemic, right? And I mean, you know, it is about isolation, want, restlessness, collective trauma. So I'd love to know what you think your relationship is between this book and the pandemic, or at least your experience of writing within that setting.
Yeah, I started it January 2020. So I did pretty much, I think I finished it, well, finished the kind of early draft in the pandemic too. So I think I pretty much wrote the whole thing in the pandemic. Yeah. So I'm like, the pandemic's still kind of going on. I started it January 2020, and the bulk of it was written in the pandemic. So it was definitely, I don't know, I mean, it changed the book materially, because I had a residency to go to France. I was going to go to the town. I was going to, like, research a lot. I was going to kind of, I was going to actually visit and kind of see everything firsthand before I even kind of got into the meat of writing it. So I think it was going to be a much different book. I think it would have been more to do with the history and different in that way, but I think also the experience of kind of being essentially locked in a room, not locked in a room writing, but, you know, I couldn't leave any, we forget how weird it was. I couldn't see anyone. I couldn't really do anything. I really clung to the book because I didn't have a very good lockdown. So the book for me was this thing that I had that I could keep working on. And I think that sense of like claustrophobia and fear, and also the idea of, you know, a massive collective trauma, because the book is taking place just after the Second World War. And I was thinking, you know, like actually everything can change so quickly. Like the world you recognize, the world you're used to being in, can just like completely flip in a second, and everything is suddenly strange. And I was like, well, that's something that they had to deal with before the poisoning even happened. Like, what does that do to a town? What does that do to like a community? Yeah, I mean, just the sense of claustrophobia. And like, no one really touches in this book, actually. I was like, this is a very sexy book, but like, it's actually not much actual sex happening. Maybe I was like reading it being like, oh, they can't actually embrace. They have to just like shoot some longing looks. So that sense of, I think, of, I just think the sense of like higher stakes and, you know, thwarted desire and just like wanting stuff really badly, and just kind of not being able to have it, and like loneliness, like, yeah, I definitely put a lot of my feelings in this book, for better or for worse, for better, hopefully.
Definitely for better. But, you know, it's a kind of like uncomfortably close source material, isn't it? It's like you think you're embarking on writing something that's very separate, that's in the past, and then suddenly it slaps you across the face.
My thing is that, you know, there's been some really great pandemic novels written. Like, I'm thinking of Burnt Coat by Sarah Hall, which is an incredible book. I wouldn't say it's a pandemic book, but it's one of those things where it's like, oh, you can definitely see like maybe the impact of the pandemic in it. It's not about a pandemic, but this is what happens when you lock a novelist with an overactive imagination in a room for like a year, and she's slowly losing her mind. She's researching this French town and can't touch anyone.
Well, at least a great novel came out of it. Aside from the pandemic, like, what are the kind of influences that you think particularly kind of set you on when you're writing?
I always wanted to write a book like A Sport and a Pastime by James Salter. I think it's the most like incredible book. I remember reading it a long time and just thinking like it was so kind of erotic, but so kind of literary and so beautiful. And so that was kind of a big influence for Curse Bread. I was kind of thinking it when I was returning to the story, this, you know, it's kind of a similar time period, that kind of sense of time slowed and like beautiful imagery. Yeah, I know like we're both as well big Javier Marías fans, and I was thinking, you know, I was kind of really interested in his use of like, you know, narrative and kind of returning to motifs and how things that seem like not connected can all build up into a bigger whole. I was reading a lot during lockdown as well while I was kind of writing the book, and I think living in this kind of living through like words a lot, as cheesy as that sounds, kind of being very absorbed in that as well.
And you're a very visual writer, so presumably like films, music maybe like also has an impact on your writing.
Yeah, completely. I always do a playlist for every book I write. And so for Curse Bread, I also had a playlist, which I was listening to a lot. And
what was in it?
I've actually sort of vaguely forgotten because I've written it so long ago. I think there was quite a lot of French music. Yeah. I think there was some like...
So you kind of like plug your headphones in when you're writing and just like take yourself to the soundtrack that you've created.
Also quite a lot of like classical music. I think just things that kind of can really help you visualize like a scene, things that can help you like visualize like a color palette or something that's happening, just anything to kind of like trick me into getting into the mood to write, basically.
Great. I wondered, like, now that you've written three novels, which is very impressive, you must like at this point, you know, the critics start talking about you in terms of like your evolution, like what is a Sophie McIntosh thing to do? But I mean, for yourself, like, are you aware of how you've evolved as a writer, or like how your interests may have changed, or like how your style even may have changed?
That is such a nice question. And also, like, I mean, I was like, I've written three books. That's a really nice,
right.
Nice question to like be asked. I think I'm, you know, I am conscious of the idea of the fact that I can be like vague and ambiguous. I never want that to feel like purposeless. I never want that to feel like it doesn't have a purpose. And I guess the more I write, the more I'm kind of understanding why I do that, or kind of getting a handle. I was actually thinking, I was talking about it to my mum on the way here, and she was like, oh, when you've talked about cursed bread, like, it feels like it's your favourite. And I was like, I don't have favourites. And I was like, I do have favourites. And it's nice to kind of to be writing books and feeling like you have, working towards something or having more of a handle on your material, or, yeah, feeling like you kind of feel more in control of the process, like, of actual writing. And those moments where you, like, you write something and you're like, I nailed it. And then, like, you know, maybe in, like, a couple of weeks you'll be like, I did not nail that. But at the time, you feel like, yes, okay, I'm like, this thing which is so nebulous and which I'm trying to kind of, you know, like, really pin down, this sense of feeling or, you know, an experience. I want readers to be having this visceral experience. I want them to be, really, really, I keep saying feeling. but, you know, to figure out kind of what you're doing and to pin it down and to be like, yes, I did it there. It's such a great thing. So I do think I'm kind of, getting there. And
what's your kind of relationship to your public self as a writer and your private self as a sense of a writer? Like, do you find that those things can not quite click together? Like, do you now kind of feel more comfortable in the public mode, or does it always feel like a slightly strange extension of something what you're asked to do when you write books?
I think it's really hard to have a separation in this sort of day and age, isn't it? Because it's kind of, you're on social media and stuff. So I don't really feel like there's that kind of much difference, I guess. I feel kind of basically the same for both. But then obviously, you know, like, if there's always, you try to be like, I think it's like the kind of personality equivalent of like podcast voice when I do a podcast, and then suddenly I'm like, hello, I'm Sophie McIntosh and I'm talking about my book. That sense of, trying to have more of a thick skin, or trying to, have more of a handle on kind of what I'm doing.
Do you like read your reviews and Goodreads and all of that paraphernalia?
My friend calls it bad reads. but I do know what I think by this point, again, like, three books in, hooray. I kind of like don't really mind so much, and I think at first, you know, it's like, you know, when you have your first book out, it's absolutely terrifying that anyone would not like what you've written, and it feels really painful. But then it's like, yeah, actually, like, nothing's going to be for everyone. In a way, it's kind of nice to not be able to please everyone, because it means you're doing something a bit different, I think. Or, you know, obviously, if everyone hated my books, that would be, like, not good. But I think to have developed a bit of a thick skin and to be able to understand, like, really, sometimes it's not me. Sometimes it's, like, or sometimes it is me. And actually, it doesn't matter if it is me. It's completely fine.
Sounds very healthy.
Sometimes at parties, my best friend will go onto Amazon and look at my one-star reviews, and if I've had some drinks, he'll get them to read them out in a sort of dramatic monologue.
Also, sounds
around,
very
hang
healthy.
For that.
I was just thinking, it's like curveball, but when you mentioned your mum, and then I made eye contact with her. Hello. I think it's right that your dad is a GP. I could just ask them. That your dad is a GP and that your mum was a nurse?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah.
do you think, like, their jobs have had any influence on you? I'm just thinking because, like, obviously your writing is so steeped in, like, bodily autonomy, it's very visceral, and there is, like, I don't know, a very much an awareness of, like, the physical nature of our lives. And that sounds very fluffy, but I'm just throwing it at you anyway as to whether you think they've had any effect.
I can't actually look at my parents at this point because I'm going to start laughing. I just think my parents just remembering, like, me, like, coming downstairs and I'm, like, deep in my dad's BMJs, like, all the medical journals, being like, absolutely horrifying myself. I was reading all this stuff about, like, you know, illness and stuff, because that was kind of what we had lying around. I think I've always been like, I've always had a consciousness of the body and the things that can go wrong with bodies. But, you know, and kind of, yeah, I don't know, that again, it kind of goes back to the idea of, like, that feeling and kind of visceral stuff, and the idea of, like, you know, existing in a body, and kind of, yeah, fascination with that kind of thing.
Mm. And obviously, just like being, without it sounding really blah, but like, obviously, like, being a woman, you are kind of made aware of, like, I sometimes feel like when critics kind of talk about your writing as dystopian and in these crazy horrible worlds, it kind of feels quite convenient, because I feel like so much of the time you're kind of tilting tilting the world in order to kind of get the reader closer to something that's true, right? Mm. That is difficult and hard to face. Mm. And I kind of wonder whether, yeah, that is what you think that you're exploring. You're kind of exploring stuff that is very familiar to us.
Mm. I think there's something in kind of, you know, going really deep into things that are very familiar, like our bodies, and I guess like making it weird again. It's something like I think I felt it especially with Blue Ticket, which is, you know, it's about a woman who is not allowed to get pregnant and she becomes pregnant. And I went so deep into pregnancy stuff in that book because the more I was like, oh, like this is normal pregnancy stuff, or we're told it's normal pregnancy stuff, and I was like, it's so weird. I was like, actually, the concept that we grow another person inside us is very weird, and there's so many things around that. Yeah, all these kind of things that I guess we don't really think about, all these things we do, like we take for granted, just kind of existing. If we actually like slow down and look at it, it's like, isn't it kind of incredible that we're just sort of walking around and, you know, all these things are happening and we're experiencing so much that we don't even like really kind of think about.
Completely. I should stop there because I think it is time for some questions from the audience, if anyone has any. If you do, maybe raise your hand.
Was it always a very short book? Like, did the word count fluctuate up and down? Oh, thank you. Did the word count fluctuate up and down? Were you like, are you a big cutter, or was it always just concise?
I think I do kind of tend towards the more concise, but I think, yeah, Cursed Bread, it was always quite concise. I think it's like, it's so intense, and I guess it happens within like quite like a kind of small time frame as well, so it kind of, there was a bit of fluctuation, it went sort of up and down, but it definitely was always kind of towards the small end. But I think like with like previous books, I've maybe like cut like 20,000 words or something, but that didn't really happen with Kiss Bread. It was always just, yeah, super intense. But yeah, I'm always big in favor of kind of losing words rather than adding. Like,
How do you stay disciplined with writing? Like, do you set yourself a target of like 1,000 words a day, or do you do like, I'm going to write from like 9 till 5? How do you stay disciplined with it?
I think I'm not very good with like kind of a daily like deadline, but I try and set myself like maybe like a weekly or monthly. So it's kind of like, if one day I haven't done it for whatever reason, that I can kind of like make it up. So otherwise I kind of feel like I get a bit discouraged, like, and also kind of, you know, things come up, or there's other like work and you know, life happens and stuff. So I think having like a more kind of like weekly or even like monthly kind of deadline for myself, I find it just be easier to kind of make up the time, if that makes sense. But I think also like figuring out what sort of time works for you as well. Like, I guess by this point I've figured out like I'm really bad at writing in like the afternoons, but like evenings for me are great, and also like kind of morning. So kind of figuring out when my brain is going to be like kind of at its most useful as well, and taking advantage of that.
I have another sort of process question. I was wondering, when you start a novel, do you feel like you start with character or with plot, or how can you kind of describe like what makes an idea a new novel for you, and how you begin, I guess?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I feel like for each book, it's kind of been a little bit different, and they often start the same way, which is like a random sentence on a notes app in my phone, which sort of then becomes bigger. With Cursed Bread, it was kind of like the story, and with Blue Ticket, it was kind of more the idea for a character who was kind of like a character who was not allowed to be pregnant but wanted to be pregnant and became pregnant, and that then kind of transformed. So it sounds really unhelpful maybe, so like it starts with a line, but I think like from there it normally kind of develops into character for me, because I am so interested in kind of the interiority of the characters and interested in their experience more than a kind of larger world building. But yeah, kind of figuring out who the character is after that kind of first line.
How did you find being longlisted for the Booker? I mean, did that destabilize your writing at all, or did it inspire it? Or because it just, I mean, that's such an enormous achievement, it just must have thrown you or built you in some way.
Yeah, it was an incredible experience. I think I was so afraid it would destabilize me that I was like, I will go the opposite. And I was like this is such an amazing thing. And yeah, I'm really lucky to have like such a good support network around me with writing and stuff, and it just it honestly gave me like such a boost and just made me feel like really determined. It kind of, I think it's always like as a debut novelist as well, especially like you kind of feel a bit like, I've accidentally done this. like I'm going to be found out. Oh, what have I done? This is awful. And to, you know, kind of have that endorsement and like, no, like you've done all right. Like you haven't been found, you've actually done something like great and you should sort of carry on doing it. That's kind of what I took away from it. Not to sound like arrogant, but you know, that kind of sense of, it just felt like a really nice endorsement of my writing. And I, you know, really in that way, it really sort of boosted my confidence and was, yeah, incredibly helpful.
Two questions. One, do you still write poetry? And two, has any of your poetry ever been the genesis of your ideas for your novels?
I do write poetry. I was sorry laughing because I was like,
can we
no
read
one
it?
Can ever see it because it's terrible. I was like, I will never see the light of day. But I do occasionally still write poetry. My next book that I'm working on now, I kind of, it came from like a poem, literally kind of just a line in the poem, and then I was like, oh, this is great. Again, it starts with a line. So that's kind of been useful in that way. But yeah, my poems, they're not good. they're just not good. It's also kind of like, I think it's kind of nice to have something writing-wise that is not good. And it's just like a thing you do for yourself and no one needs to see ever.
Can we hear about the next book?
No.
You've always got to ask.
It's a weird love story.
Okay.
And it is set in a kind of, you're going to be so surprised to hear it's set in like a kind of uncanny world, not like our own.
Shall I go? Yeah. I'm interested in what you said before about not describing the setting in too much detail and so that the reader has opportunity to fill it in or it's not so circumscribed. But it must have been quite disorienting not to have had the, think that you were going to have the residency and to go to the place where your novel was set and then not be able to do that. And I really hope that you did end up taking that up in the end. But how did you find that, not having been to the place where it's set, or had you already been there and did you have all those memories stored up about the setting?
I'd been to sort of places in the region before, so I was working from memory there, but also like it was a long time ago. I mean, there was points where I was literally on Google Maps kind of like looking at it being like, this is not an adequate like, you know, replacement for going there. And I think again, like, kind of, I think that's why I did end up kind of going a more speculative route in the end, because I was like, well, you know, I can't actually do the sense of place justice. I'm basically writing from a different place. There is actually another novel written about the poisoning by Barbara Commons, and I actually didn't read it before I wrote Cursed Bread. I read it now, and I'm finding it really interesting because it's set, like, again, it's not set in that town, it's set in a different place. It's like that idea of, you know, you sort of take the idea of something and then you kind of transplant it somewhere else, and that's kind of what I felt I was doing. But yeah, it was like hard because sometimes in my head I'd have this whole vision of this town and I'd be like, well, that's like not how it happened at all, like that's not like what it looked like. This is completely like a sort of imagined place, and then I go back to the Google Maps and look at satellite image. So it was strange, but I think it kind of, that sense of almost like creating a different place in your mind, I think that was useful in its kind of own, in its own way. But I do kind of like to think about what kind of book it would have been if I'd be able to do it the way I'd sort of first planned, like what it kind of would have ended up like. But I think like when we write any kind of book, like there's always like a ghost book or kind of, you know, there's a different direction something could have forked out in. There's always like the bits that you kind of, you cut and you don't keep, or there's the point where you decide you want to change direction completely. And
yeah, I've wondered three books in if you've ever been tempted or would be tempted in the future to have a male narrator and a male voice rather than a female voice.
Yeah, for sure. I'm not reading it up. No, there is kind of, I guess that's the thing about having, yeah, writing a book now in like third person, because it's kind of, you're kind of less in someone's head and you do get more of like the viewpoint of like, there's more of a viewpoint of a kind of a male character, and it's kind of, it's not like even a conscious decision I made necessarily all the time. It was kind of just what I felt drawn to in the books and what kind of felt right for the story. But I definitely would.
Shall I say thank you?
Please.
Thank you all very much for your questions and your contributions. And say a big thank you to Rebecca and Sophie. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.